This week's episode is sponsored by MetroSpecs. MetroSpecs is the premier location for designer eyewear in Fayetteville. Some of the brands kept at MetroSpecs are Sean John, Gucci, Christian Dior, Kate Spade, Silhouette, and more. MetroSpecs is located at 201 South McPherson Road. For more information, go to metrospecs.us.
For I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town. Yes, I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round. To be back where the boys all know me, back where the girls all bow.
This is the North Carolina Theater Story Show. I'm your host, Lynn Pryor. James Johnson is our technical director. You can listen to this and all previous episodes at NorthCarolinaTheaterStories.com. We're coming to you from a 100-year-old house, former home of the Gilbert Theater, here in historic Haymont in Fayetteville, North Carolina. This is show number 23. Our guest today is Matt Lamb. Matt Lamb is a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He moved to North Carolina 4 years ago. While here, Matt has appeared in numerous shows at the Gilbert, CFRT, Cape Fear Regional Theater, the Temple. He played the part of Matt in The Fantastics, was in Christmas Carol twice, Harpo Marx in Groucho, Mark in Rent, Dr. Frankenstein in Young Frankenstein, The Captivo, in Company of Wayward Saints. At CFRT, Demetrius in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Anthony in Sweeney Todd, Mr. Wickham in Pride and Prejudice. He's also appeared in Sweet Tea Shakespeare, Benedict in Much Ado, Ernest in The Importance of Being Ernest, Temple Theater, Corny Collins in Hairspray. Matt, welcome.
Well, hello.
He did six more shows during the introduction.
I'm sure. Yeah, right.
Well, we sometimes frown on such long, ego-driven introductions, but we're accepting it this time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Anyway, Matt, we've just been listening, haven't we, to that wonderful theme song of ours.
Of course.
Longing to Be on Old Broadway. Cole Porter, 1913. And but if you could be there, what would it be?
I'm going to have to go with, as of right now, my choice would have to be, I would love to be the Phantom of the Opera right now.
As the lead.
Of course.
Well, you were wearing a Phantom mask the other day. We're going to get to that in just a moment.
I was.
So, well, all right, Phantom, well, you were thinking big here tonight, folks. Now, Matt, in front of you, you see the famous red box.
Yes, I do.
And this is sometime, do not open it yet.
Oh, please. I'm sorry. What's in the box?
We've had this box. I'm sure one day it's going to end up disappearing because people will figure he can't possibly continue doing this very cruel thing to his guests if the box is missing. But it's with us right now, and I want you in a moment, open it, take out what you find, and describe it very briefly, then tell us a fabulous story. All right, open that box.
All right, here we go. Ooh, there is a very beautiful mask with music notes. It is a black and gold mask with well, it seems to be sheet music above the eyebrows. So I need to tell you a quick story.
Yes.
About this mask.
Yes, and it might be true. It might be, you might have owned this mask at one time. It might be all made up or a combination.
Well, let's see. Since it is a mask, I would have to say that I was very fortunate to wear a mask two times since I've been here in North Carolina. Once as the Capitano in Company of Wayward Saints with the Rep Company at the Gilbert Theater. And also, Saturday that has just passed, I wore a Phantom of the Opera mask at my reception for my wedding, which was actually here at your house.
Well, you segued into that beautifully. Wonderful. That's exactly what I was going to say next. Before we get to that, I want to... James said we put the listener challenge way too deep into the hour, Matt. And so I've moved it up in this rather awkward spot, but I'm doing it anyway because James was insistent. Because I was upset because nobody was... We only had one response to our listener challenge.
Okay.
And that was somebody from your hometown of Pittsburgh.
Yay!
And that was the Who is George Spelvin. But now I put it up here now. It's another George. Who is George Peele? P-E-E-L-E. Now, And if you know, I don't want you to... If you say you know it, who he was, I don't want you to tell me.
Well, good.
I should have mentioned that to you.
I know one thing, and that's it. And
this is a listener challenge. We have a fabulous gift awaiting the person who solves it. Next...
A brand new BMW.
Well, it's...
I won't guarantee that.
One of those Matchbox toy things. Mm. If indeed it's that... But I'm tempted to give a clue. James, what do you think?
I think you should go ahead and do that. Don't ever fight your temptations.
All right. Well, this is rather alarming. I'm going to have to call your mother. She should know. You're saying such kind of...
Unless your temptation involves my mother.
Over the top. Anyway, so I am going to give a clue for this listener challenge. Who is George Peele? He is someone that is a real person in 17th century England in Elizabethan times. That's all I'm going to say. All right, Matt. Yes. Married man.
Yes.
And leading man.
Wow.
I am so impressed with both of those. Yes, this past Saturday, you and the artistic director... at the Gilbert, Robin Parrish, tied the knot at the North Carolina, at the Cape Fear Botanical Garden, the beautiful garden, with a group of friends and family there. And then, later in the afternoon, 150 people or so arrived here at the Gilbert Garden for the reception. And what did you think of the costumes?
Ouch. I mean, there was nothing. I got to say, there was everything that you could possibly imagine came through the door. So, which was great. I mean, that was the whole purpose of the...
Because it was, after all, the 31st, it was Halloween.
It was on Halloween.
And so we were really sweating, Bob and I, with working in the garden, that it was going to rain, but it held off for about 6 minutes. No, it didn't rain until the following day, thank God. But we had wonderful costumes coming in. Wasn't the guest list wonderful?
What was wonderful about the guest list, and again, it was kind of hard to thank, you know, because Facebook seems to be a little bit easier than, right, you know, getting out information. And one of the things that I said was we didn't celebrate our day with a lot of friends. We celebrated it with family, and that includes everyone. Not blood related, right, or anything like that. It involved everybody that was there. So what was fun about it was everyone was just in the spirit of it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a day for Robin and myself, but it was a day for everybody.
Yes.
And that's what we wanted it to be.
Well, it was. No, the theater family, in the richest sense of that phrase, was so evident that day. I had great fun. I was wearing a poncho and a leather mask.
That's right. That was the poncho.
Yes, it was. I love that. That I won at an auction, and so anyway, that was great fun. We had a wonderful DJ who was singing and playing guitar, Tyler, and there was a dance with you and your bride.
There was,
and he was wearing the phantom mask,
yes,
half mask. And I said to Robin later after the dance ended, I thought too late to suggest that you, as the dance ended, that you tear off the mask and scream.
Oh, yes, if she was to take it off of me.
But
I thought
that would be a nice that would be a nice button for that romantic dance. Anyway, so then they threw the bouquet. It, all those elements were there, but wonderful food. And so Bob and I just were thrilled to prepare the garden for it. The Gilbert Garden has been the scene of so many wonderful things. Rhonda Brocky and Ralph Warren and Frank Warren. Ralph was another husband of hers. No, I'm just kidding. anyway, so they had a reception there years ago. And so, and our Gilbert gatherings and goodness knows play is there. So the garden has been a place of a site for wonderful events. And certainly Saturday Matt was one of the highlights for me. Now, so yeah, leading a married man and a leading man, when I saw you most recently in Young Frankenstein, yes. I said to Robin, he has become a leading man.
Well, I would hope so, because that show was, it was amazing what was able to be done with such a large show and then such an intimate space as the Gilbert and how it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
For us.
Well, the magic, I think the magic of stage sizes downstairs, 11 and a half feet by 13, and what we did yeah. there, I mean, you can't believe it. And now, at the present location, they're on Bow Street, 25 by 25, and it never ceases to amaze me. But yes, that's so true. But you, as a leading man, you know, one of the first little kind of truisms I heard years and years ago was, well, you know, that person is an actor who sings. Or someone would say to me, well, that's a singer who does some acting. And like that. Well, you are both. You are a leading man. You're a fine actor who wouldn't have to just rely on your voice because of your talent. Having seen you enough times, but in my mind, you moved over into that category of leaning man at the ripe old age of 33, whatever you are.
Close.
And anyway, so yes, your singing voice is just a joy. Now, you had some wonderful songs to sing in Young Frankenstein, didn't you?
Yes. Oh, boy. Well, I mean, there's always, because of the movie... and there's a whole history behind having that song put into the movie.
Which one is that?
Put on the Ritz.
Oh,
which
right.
was yes. a Gene Wilder push, and Mel Brooks said, no, that's never going to work. It's never going to work. And Gene fought him tooth and nail.
The scene itself.
Yeah, and they put it in, and...
Well, that's a highlight of the movie.
I thought that Gene Wilder should have got a writing credit as far as the both the play and... And the film goes. I think he might have got it on the film. I was surprised to didn't see his name listed as a writer on the show.
Yeah, you know, thinking about that, it is kind of interesting that his name's not on the show. I wonder why. I mean, it's not like they had a falling out or
anything. He came to Brooks with the idea of doing the show.
Well, I think that's how it got off the ground, too, is how the movie was made was done with Blazing Saddles. Like, because I guess there was an actor that was supposed to play... the Waco kid. There was an actor that they had cast, and the guy was—he was a drunk. They couldn't. Mm-hmm. He was drunk.
Ironically,
set. Yeah, they couldn't get him. Right. He couldn't get through takes. So Mel called Gene and said, "Could you please do this movie?" And from what I understand from the stories, and it might be telephone gaming this story, but he said, "I'll do it as long as you do Young Frankenstein." And he said, "Okay." So that's how he got him to be in the movie. So he was flying across the country to go do this movie, and he was learning the script and writing different things in.
Oh,
and
I see. Well, he was brilliant.
Yeah.
I wish him well. I understand he's not well. I hope that he gets well soon. So, yeah, an actor who sings, a singer who acts, you're both of them. Another song that I thought was so wonderful is When the Creature Comes Alive, and you...
Life, I think that's, or Life, it might be just Life. That was one of my favorite songs to sing in the show because it wasn't zany it was zany to a certain extent, but it didn't have like the first song that I have to sing, The Brain, where it's all this tongue twisting and, you know, it was very serious. It's like a serious moment for him, you know, it's bringing the creature to life. That's my favorite song in the show.
Well, you are brilliant, and the cast, everybody was equally brilliant. I felt we had Iago here a few weeks ago, but you know there were 12 performances. I saw 11 of them.
That's right.
And it was certainly no chore. I tried to do that, but it was absolutely no chore. I missed the 12th one. I had to be, didn't have to be. I love football, and I was at a football game. Mm-hmm. So, Matt, can you think back to the early days in Pittsburgh when you first, perhaps when your first play, when you first were conscious, became conscious of what theater was?
Being a child of the 80s, I enjoyed, obviously, I mean, film. Like, I would just sit there and watch movie after movie, you know, cartoons that had this own. I don't have any brothers or sisters, so I had this whole big imagination. And my grandfather actually was a very, I used to like to call it beautiful music, or he called it beautiful music. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Tony Bennett, all those different things. So I remember every Sunday we would have dinner, as we would say. It was really like lunch, but you'd be pulling up the driveway, and you could hear Frank Sinatra blaring at the bottom of the, you know, my grandfather with records and stuff. And he'd be playing that, dancing around the house on Sundays. And I loved music. I just, it was an escape. Like, I just loved all types of music. Like, I think most of my cassettes in the 80s were all, like, movie soundtracks. And I think I had a Genesis album and, like, maybe a, there might have been one other randomly. But it was all either movies, movie soundtracks, or there'd be a few like musical soundtracks that I would have. And my grandfather really got me into music.
Your father's father?
No, my mother's father. I never met my well, I was a baby. He passed away when I was way too young to remember him. But I just enjoyed that, just that escape, like that whole world of making something. It's just stories. I love telling stories, whether it's lyrics
in a song or on a play or a combination, which you really thrive.
But I think it was more, I mean, I sang in like kindergarten through third grade, you know, whatever. But I think once I got to like, I think it was fifth grade, I had a music teacher that she pushed me, you should sing this song. And I got up and sang. We had like a spring concert and I sang. And I really enjoyed it. And then once I got to high school, 9th through 12th grade, I was in the high school chorus. And the teacher there had a what she called as like a lead chorus. It's like a show choir, basically. Uh-huh. And I auditioned 9th grade and I got in. A friend of mine who was also, she was a wonderful singer, her parents used to take me to go see shows. And I think the first show that I ever saw that really was like, wow, this is very interesting. I saw CMU, that's Carnegie Mellon University. I saw them do Hair. I knew nothing about it. And we're in the front row.
Oh, boy.
And this is my first like big theater experience. And we're in the front row of Hair. And I'm just really enjoying the music. It's just fantastic. And we get down towards the end of the first act. And I have no idea. I'm like, where are they all going? They're going underneath this tarp. And then, boom, they all come back out. And surprise, surprise. And I'm like they don't have any pants. So, but her parents, they took me to see shows. I saw, I believe it was the national tour of Chicago. And we saw that, I think it was the next year. And I'm just fat, like, you know, just watching this story unfold, like an orchestra behind them and the dancing and the singing. And I remember absolutely gasping out loud when the big reveal of Mary Sunshine. And I don't know what the line is that, I don't know if it's Billy Flynn or who says the line. It's like something doesn't, nothing, it's something, not everything appears to be whatever it is. And he pulls the wig off and it was this very slender, beautiful black woman that was playing Mary Sunshine and pulls the wig off and it was a man. And I actually yelled out in the middle of Heinz Hall in Pittsburgh, no way! Like, because I was so into the story.
Yes.
But my friend also got me hooked up with a group from 11th to 12th grade. I'm sorry. My high school, we started doing, segueing into this, we started doing musicals my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. And I was in Music Man. I was in the quartet.
Oh.
And it was, I mean, I'll never forget. It was probably 15, 16, 17 years ago, whatever. And I'll never forget that. It was, yeah. It's the most comfortable. It's really weird. Even now to this day, I'm most comfortable on stage. Outside of the stage, I'm very like, I think a lot of people, maybe actors are like that, but it's, yeah. Well, I'm kind of, yeah. I don't know. I feel more comfortable on stage than I do anywhere else because it's a safe zone for me. So from Music Man, from doing Music Man to Annie to Hello Dolly and then getting into college.
Yes.
And just having to pursue it. There was nothing else.
Yes.
I had a professor in college that I was auditioning for the college. And I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed when it comes to the academics, but theater I would excel at. Mm-hmm. You know, that was easier for me. And I remember a gentleman who, one of the judges, I guess, or someone sitting in the college audition, I sang my song, I did my monologue. And he said, they were kind of looking at me, and as I was walking out the door, he asked me, he was like, why do you want to do this? And I turned around and looked at him. I said, because there's nothing else on earth that I would be good doing. And I walked out. Years later, I actually saw my audition sheet. Somehow I got into my file. It's a long story. And I saw that I wasn't accepted from this guy. And then he crossed it out and put accepted.
Wow.
So I was hoping that that's...
I bet that was what it turned to.
I'm hoping so.
No, I suspect it is. I'm reading this, yet another Stephen Fry autobiography. I've talked about that. He's written three of them. I read the earlier one, now this one. And his experience was, as a kid, saw the importance of being earnest.
Mm.
And his life was changed from that moment on. So I think really outstanding theater people have, perhaps this is a common story. Matt, now I was listening, Diane Rehm was on today, and she was interviewing Stephen King about his new book of short stories. And he was talking about being a writer, but I think that applies to the performing arts as well. And he said, I call myself an amateur to this day. And he said, I'm always learning. He said, I am always improving, never really satisfied, but always improving. And how do you feel about that as a theater artist?
Well, that's absolutely true. You never stop learning. You learn something new every time. You can't go in, you know, unless I think even for what we consider like masters of the craft, like let's say, you know, Patrick Stewart, let's say Sir Ian McKellen, these actors, Anthony Hopkins.
Meryl Streep just phones it in.
Meryl Streep, yeah, or whatever. Oh, my 30th Academy Award. There's no way you never stop learning. Can you bring something that you've used prior to a show? Absolutely. But there's always something different.
Yeah.
It's always like getting a new box. Uh-huh. You know, even though the box may look the same, but when you open it up, what's in there is going to be different. Uh-huh. So, it's a never ending.
But that can be fed by seeing a lot of plays that you just as a patron, be fed by reading books. I'm a big one to this day, reading biographies, autobiographies of theater people. That's been a great source of interest to me, and a great source of learning as well. So there are all kinds of avenues for this improvement, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you read. It's interesting to see, like James said, like you see like Meryl Streep, and she, you know, you read something that, where did she learn? Like, what did she learn? And then you see these, like, it's almost like you're getting a little bit of what's in their head, like what drives them, what helps them. Mm-hmm. Produce the work that they do.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to see that, whether you be method or, you know, you create.
How did they do that? I was a children's librarian, and I would have children's authors come in as guests to talk to the children. And one of my guests was a man who didn't have much formal education, but he said that he learned to write by simply looking at the work of writers that he admired, and looking at a sentence, looking at a paragraph, and saying to himself, how did he do this? How did he get me to feeling this way? So in the, you know, that's true, I think, of all the creative aspects of our lives. So Matt, what is next for you?
Next would be a holiday working retail. Since retail is my job, there's really no time to, since it is going to be the holiday season, there's really no...
But you're in the rep, though.
No, I'm not.
You're not in the
rep. No, I stepped down to allow, because it's too hard for, because of my work schedule, to kind of figure out like what's... I try to plan it out far enough in advance that I'm able to...
Of course,
do shows and then,
But nothing in this rest of the season for you so far?
No, so far no.
But next season, I bet there'll be something.
I'm hoping. Okay. You never know. Even though I may have married the boss, I have no idea what's going on in her head. So.
We're all watching that very carefully to see if favoritism rears its ugly head. Now, time for your monologue.
Excellent.
And you were choosing what source?
I am going to do a monologue, which I'm going to be reading, but I'll definitely do it for your audience. Since I was talking about going back and asking where did it all start, I would like to do Cornelius's monologue from Hello, Dolly.
Oh, good.
At the end of the show when he is in front of the judge after they all get arrested.
So remind us briefly this storyline.
Hello, Dolly is the musical. Is a musical written by Jerry Herman, who is, if you haven't listened to Jerry Herman, please go out and listen to Jerry Herman. It's an American treasure. Don't tempt.
This all started as a.
It was a play. Yes,
The Matchmaker.
The Matchmaker. Thank you. And I couldn't think of what the play was. Uh-huh. Cornelius is a store clerk who works for Mr. Horace Van de Gelder that just wants a day off, and he can never get a day off. And he decides that him and his partner Barnaby, they decide we're going to take a day off and go to New York City. And they're in Yonkers, and so they make all the canned goods explode in the storage unit, and they leave. And in the course of that, they run into a woman's hat shop, and he meets Miss Irene Malloy, who runs the hat shop. But she's also supposed to be meeting his boss, Mr. Van de Gelder. So there's this comedic scene that plays out with him being there and Barnaby and Cornelius being there. And eventually and of course there's always Dolly Levi, but since we're telling the Cornelius story, they end up getting arrested at the Harmonia Gardens because all hell breaks loose. And they're in front of a judge, and judge asks him to speak, and he ends up doing this wonderful monologue where he speaks his heart. You know, he doesn't care about what's going to happen, because he seems to be a very, I don't want to say a nervous Nelly before them, maybe a little bit. But he's thrown caution to the wind all up until now, and now he just decides to let it all out. And he's actually going to profess his love to Mrs. Malloy, who he meets in just a day. And I don't know, it was the first monologue I ever did on stage, so I figured
for
your podcast,
what
the hell. Hopefully it's gotten better since high school. So... here we go. Let's give it a try. Isn't the world full of wonderful things? There I sat, cooped up in Yonkers for years and years, and all the time wonderful people like Mrs. Malloy were walking around New York, and I didn't know any of them at all. I don't know whether you can all see from where I'm sitting. Well, for instance, the way her eye and her forehead and her cheek come together up there. Can you? I tell you right now, a fine woman is the greatest work of God on earth. You can talk all you want about Niagara Falls and the pyramids. They ain't in it at all. Oh, of course, I've seen women before, but today I talk to one equal to equal. And they're different from men. They're awful mysterious, too. I bet you could know a woman 100 years without really knowing sure whether she really likes you or not. Today I've lost so many things, my job, my future, everything that people think is important, but I don't care. Even if I have to dig ditches for the rest of my life, I'll be a ditch digger who once had a wonderful day.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, Matt, thank you. I was picturing those wonderful Technicolor scenes in that movie. Thank you. Well, it's time for our free-for-all, and I'm glad that Mary is returning to our table, and she's going to sit and join the free-for-all. And James, we would appreciate your input as well as Matt's and mine. The question is, this week, is thinking on stage, is it a good idea, or appearing to think on stage, let's say, is it a good idea or should not happen? We're going to be looking at Udo Hagen's book, Talents for the Actor, has several pages on this that I want to reference in a bit. Page 106, for example, is, let's cut that part.
Okay.
All right. It's a free for all. Thinking on stage. Any thoughts about thinking on stage? All right. Mary does.
Okay.
Mary perked up very quickly, think Mary, you should go.
I've been sitting there thinking. It's a good show that you brought this up because actually, my first thought was that, we think in real life, so it's just kind of about being present. You're still thinking, just being present. Mm-hmm. So not so much thinking, I'm going to move over here, I'm going to move over here. But there's one instance in particular, I keep meaning to tell Matt about this, but I always forget, and so now I'm telling you now, that in Company of Wayward Saints, one of my favorite parts, well, there's Joyce Leib with that lollipop, that was one. But another part was toward the end, when all the actors are, I could see Matt deciding to go back to his hometown and start a church. That's what I saw.
Oh, the play, yes.
And that was a thought in your head. You didn't say that. And I saw that very clearly with a lot of people on stage. A lot of things going on, other people talking. But I saw that in you thinking. But that was, in the moment as the character, too. And that was, my favorite part of the show. Along with Joyce and her lollipop, that's more outward. And this was I saw that. And I was going to tell you that, but I never got to tell you. So there's my thought on that.
Matt.
Well, depending on, what are you thinking about? You've got to stay present to what you're doing. It's going to come down to concentration. Are you in the moment or are you not in the moment? You should always stay in the moment. But what if, for instance, something just that you've never thought of comes up? Should you, I'm thinking, I'm scratching my head, I'm going to twiddle my mustache. There's ways of doing it without being cheesy, or maybe you're playing a character that's not supposed to be being focused on at that point. Maybe, you are in the scene, but, the importance is on someone else. You don't want to pull that focus off of because you're like, my character has a brilliant idea, but I'm townsperson number three. But to a certain extent, thinking on stage, absolutely, because you may find something that when you're saying a line or you're saying something, you didn't realize, what if it means this?
Well, the given circumstances will help you make these decisions, of course. Uta Hagen in her book, Challenge for the Actors, talks about, our thoughts are as fast as light years. And so she frowns on naturalistic stuff. Well, I'm thinking now, I'm going to pretend I'm thinking. But if the thoughts need to be, as you say, in the moment, they need to be having to do with your character, the other characters. But James, any thoughts?
Well, rarely do I have thoughts, but I'm gonna stretch my thinking muscles right now, and I think that there's a chance that just the question in itself is almost misleading. There's a difference between thinking as in, for example, you're on stage and a glass falls and you're considering, I wonder if I should pick that up. thinking as in indicating, as in showing the audience, I'm thinking, I'm rubbing my chin and furrowing my eyebrows. I think when one's talking about it, you don't want to be seen thinking on stage. It's more in line with saying that, people don't give a big show when they're actually having thoughts. They don't. They don't. They thinking is something that we're all doing all the time naturally. It's not something we need to indicate.
Indicating is one of the no-nos for that whole world, absolutely. But we do, the thoughts are, fast as light year, that something falls on the stage that wasn't supposed to. That happens almost in any play. But your thinking is so fast, you already, this is a really good, I'm glad you brought this is a really good example of how somebody up there who's really in the moment, in character, will do the right thing in picking it up in character or whatever.
One of my most shameful moments or proudest moments, I can't decide which, I go back and forth, is I was doing a show and it was a comedy and I was playing this news anchor. It was a show written by Stephen Miles, and the news anchor was an idiot, basically. So it wasn't a huge stretch. During the show, it's a break room scene, and I'm supposed to go to the coffee maker and pour myself a cup of coffee, I'm drinking this coffee throughout the scene. I go to the coffee maker and I grab the cups, and the only cups that are left on stage, apparently the prop person forgot to place the real cups, are the cups that were glued to the table. So I grab a cup and I try to pick it up and it moves the table a little. And I'm like, oh God, I don't know what to do. I have to be drinking coffee. So I just grab the coffee maker and I start drinking directly from it. It's a huge laugh. But once I was backstage, the actor who had the most lines in that scene, like, comes up to me and says, I nearly broke because you were drinking from this. That's not physically possible. You would have been burnt. And I was like, they got a laugh.
But I think this, Mary, something to add.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just thinking, because we just had Adam's family. And in the scene where Robin Parrish is singing her big number, waiting, there's a lot of, like, reacting. And there are a lot of people on stage. And I'm reacting with other ancestors and, of course, reacting to whatever Robin's doing. Mm-hmm. She gives me a lot to react to. So,
yeah, we all loved watching you.
Oh, good.
Throughout your time.
That's funny, because I'm trying to think, so I was thinking, okay, so when she goes here, so don't do this, because this is, you're thinking a little bit of, I'm moving my hand up and down like mm-hmm. a wave in an ocean. But then there's also the Elvis ancestor next to me. He always looks at me, and if I miss, we haven't been making that connection, so we planned before, so I have to remember, okay, never mind, I'm just babbling, I'll shut up now.
Well, thanks, Mary. No, it's very important, and Una Hagen, in her book, A Challenge of the Actor, on page 106, if you're interested, dear listeners, it goes into detail about thinking, how the mind works, human mind works, what the implications for stage work, and if you know her book and know her philosophy, being natural is nowhere. realistic, yes, but not being natural. People think all the time and all that. Well, it's different on stage. Anyway, well, anything else to add, Matt?
I think Mary and her last bit there really summed it up. Oh, I'll pound that, Mary.
Good. Well, but what we always do at this point, Matt, is we put this whole problem in the lap of St. Genesius. And I've been writing to her for the last 6 months, and one of these days I know we're getting direction. But maybe I'm just not hearing about it. But here we go. Dear St. Genesius, loving patron of the theater and its people, we ask your guidance on a perplexing question. Should actors ever appear to be thinking on stage? Do you agree with me when I answer this question with a resounding yes? Say you find yourself in a play that, too late, you see how insignificant your part really is. Now is the time to use thinking on stage to your advantage. Here, a variety of facial expressions will be a subtle way of focusing attention on you, rather than the scene hogging leads. For example, before each of your pathetic lines, stroke your brow as if Aristotle himself was inspiring your performance. or wildly gesture with your hands as if trying to bring all plot points vividly into focus. Now, never underestimate the impact of pacing. Try vigorously moving back and forth, preferably downstage, as you use all of the above, as you stride in front of the astonished principals. Of course, all of these part-expanding ideas will be helpful if you can't remember your next damn line. After all, Del Sartre needs reviving anyway. Dear St. John, we await your guidance on this important matter. Well, there it is. Any port in a storm, we'll get... All right, quiz. Time for the quiz.
Oh, boy.
All right, James has his sheet. And now, here is your prize, if you're successful.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's great...
It's a graphic, Watching the Watchmen.
That's a fantastic story.
And this one, it's a huge coffee table book, which shows how he does the work.
Mm-hmm.
And with sketches and preliminaries and all that. It's absolutely fabulous.
It might be the first graphic novel to be listed as one of the greatest books of all time.
Really?
Yeah. Watchmen has gotten on some pretty impressive lists and won a lot of really good awards.
Well, there it is. And it's yours if you are successful to a point. I mean, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, the question, I want you to turn over that blank sheet under your bed box there.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And this is what do you find there? You find we're going to be working with the most Oscar-nominated actors.
Okay.
And there are five of them that I have isolated from a longer list, Matt. And I'm going to read one of these five names. And the names are Jack Nicholson, Laurence Olivier, Paul Newman, Jack Lemmon, and Dustin Hoffman. All right, now I'll give you a name of one of these five. Then you look at your list of number of nominations and wins.
Okay.
Here's one has been nominated 8 times, they've won twice, that sort of thing. All right, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Paul Newman.
Paul Newman. God, I'm trying to think what he's been. Paul Newman. Jeez. I'm going to say, I don't think he won twice. He might have. I'm going to go nominated 7 times, won twice.
No, I'm afraid.
No,
not.
I didn't think so.
All right. Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson definitely won twice. Now, was he 7 or 8? Got it against him then, probably.
Read everything.
12 nominations, 3 wins. 10. I'm going to say 8 and 2.
No.
Damn it.
Sorry.
What Jack Nicholson won for, anyway?
Jack Nicholson won for, if I'm right, Cuckoo's Nest and As Good As It Gets. So it'd be 7 and 2.
All right. Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman won for Kramer versus Kramer. I'm going to say 9 and 1.
I'm afraid not.
Damn it.
did Dustin Hoffman win one for the one where he's a lady?
No, Tootsie, no. He did not win for Tootsie.
That wasn't even him. That was...
Yeah, that was him.
Well, that was
him. He was Tootsie, yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
All right, number 4, Laurence Olivier.
I'm going 10 and 1.
Correct. Very good. 10 and 1. And finally, Jack Lemmon.
Jack Lemmon won for... 1, 2... I'm going to say 9 and 1.
No,
I already guessed 9 and 1, didn't I? Well, it looks like that book's staying here at your house. What did he win for? What was the answer?
I don't have those. I just have the thing.
Was he in Marty?
No.
No, that wasn't him. That's... Oh, I'm thinking a quiz show of the movie. No, I got an IMDb while we're sitting here.
All right, but you... Okay, number 1, Paul Newman was 9 and 1. Jack Nicholson, 12 nominations and 3 wins.
Oh, you know what? Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't see that up there. What was the third one then?
Chinatown.
A Chinatown. And then number three, Dustin Hoffman, 7 and 2. Laurence Olivier, 10 and 1. You got that right. Number five, Jack Lemmon, 8 and 2. Well, all you had to get was one right.
Oh, good. Because that's, oh boy. If they would have just bribed me like this in high school with quizzes and tests with graphic novels of Superman and Star Wars, I would have definitely probably aced these better. Oh, this is a cool book.
So, anyway, well,
it's got pictures in it.
My quizzes aren't the easiest things in the world.
No, but this should be, I mean...
That one was a bit complex, so I'll give you that one.
Yeah, but at least, I mean, I got some of the titles right, yeah, though. I mean, I knew what the movies
were.
Well,
I should have included those. That's why I'm giving the edge and giving you that very expensive book.
Anytime you involve numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an actor. I can't read or count, so that's...
All right, time for memorable quotes. Matt and Mary and James... this one, for some months now, I remember, I've been saying it to myself and anybody who will listen, find your bliss. This life really needs, for happiness, you need to find your bliss. And Matt, you have found yours, and James, you are certainly finding yours, and Mary, so are you. But here is the exact quote from Joseph Campbell. One way or another, we all have to find what best fosters the flowering of our humanity in this contemporary life, and dedicate ourselves to that. So then I have a second one. I'm listening to BBC radio the other night. They had Alicia Alonso on. She is now 94 and one of the world's greatest ballerinas. And at the height of her career, at the time when Fidel Castro took over in Cuba, she went there and opened a ballet school and did marvelous things for decades and decades. But she said what she said in math, and this is what I think you've been saying all evening, when she said that she feels most alive, has felt, through all these decades of dancing, when the curtain goes up, she's most alive. And that's just what you've been saying to us, isn't it? All right, turning the tables, this is a time when each of you can ask me a question, anything you want. Do you have a question, Matt?
You've answered this question a million times, and I always forget the answer. How did the name Gilbert Theater come up?
Well, it is the... I knew I was moving to Fayetteville, which was named after the Marquis de Lafayette. And... And so I began reading books, biographies of him. And I decided to name the theater after him. And so the first name was going to be the name that, when he landed, he was 19 years old. He landed in what's now South Carolina. And his ship, the Victoire, and the Indians befriended him. They gave him a name. And, I thought I remembered that. Anyway, it has three syllables. And I said, that's what I'm going to call the theater. Maybe Washaw or something like that. And then one night I was lying in bed in California before I moved here, and I thought, are you out of your mind? Are you going to spend the rest, next 20, 30 years telling people how to pronounce it, how to spell it? So I went back to the book and decided to use his one of his Christian names. He had four or five of them. But the family called him Gilbert, or Gilles. And that's where it comes from.
And Marquee Theater would have been really ironic, granted, given the fact we lack a Marquee Theater.
True, that would have been another weird one. All right, James, you have a question this week.
Yes, you are an avid reader, a librarian for years. I'm curious, if there was a book that you would like to see adapted for the stage, what would that book be?
Mm-hmm.
Giving myself a pat on the back for such a question.
That is a good question.
It'll be a children's book, and it's called December Tale. It's by one of my favorite children's authors, Marilyn Sachs. She's a great friend, living in San Francisco. I would have her over to my library a number of times to speak to the children. But it tells the story of two children who live with an abusive mother, and it would make a wonderful a very sad, yes, it was, upper grades, like 5th and 6th, one act play. Mary, do you have a question?
Okay. Of any plays that you know or musicals already written, is there any particular one or two that you would like us to do?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
Please sit. There is, but I had spoken with the artistic director and urged her to do it. And I still think it's on a burner, perhaps a back burner. But unfortunately, it's my favorite musical. Not unfortunately, my favorite musical is this one. And but unfortunately, I don't know if it's going to be done or not. I do hope so.
Thunder Raps.
Well, it's a musical, and it's very powerful, and but I having said that, I can't tell you what it is because I don't want it to be out there on the airwaves and someone in the region take it.
Okay.
But so that's a kind of a screwy way of answering your question. All right. Any superstitions, Matt? You said you had one.
Yes, I do not like saying the Scottish play backstage. I definitely believe in that. I have been witness to people doing it and catastrophically suffering.
Don't tell James Dean that.
Well, James Dean, definitely. Yeah, no, James Dean, if you're out there. No, I definitely believe in saying the Scottish play backstage brings dire consequences.
Well, you're one. I've talked with so many through the years who've said that very thing. I have one too. Peacock feathers, they're never to be brought onto a stage. In any part of a costume or in an arrangement, real peacock feathers, because there's this evil eye, and people in the past. Well, these superstitions have a reputation because things have happened in the past,
yep.
And they'll say it must be this is something bad has happened in this for the second time, and there I see peacock feathers again. So we should never have them on stage. All right, you have a book to share, I understand.
Yes, and sorry, listeners, I cannot remember the title of this book, but it's a great book. It was a part of my theater history class in college. It's an anthology of plays throughout Greek civilization to present time. Whenever the book was finished, it's got, I think...
Up to modern times.
Up to modern time. I can't remember what the last plays in it. I know that it has... Any one of my... college friends that listen to the podcast or professors that can remind me of this book. I know that on the cover is yellow, green, and I believe there's three pictures on the front of the cover. I can't remember, there's three, but one of them that I do remember is William H. Macy in Oleana is on the cover. It's probably at the Gilbert. I could find that book immediately if I was looking at the bookcase.
Well, if you tell me this week, and I'll mention it next week. Thank you, Matt. So those are the plays you found those wonderful to read, and
absolutely,
and you just carried it around in your backpack. All right, mailbox, James. Do we have any communications this week?
No new communications. I'm hoping to. Oh yeah, we actually did. We did get one message. It was from Mimi.
Oh good.
And she just wanted to comment that she thought that the women who had been on the show recently needed to speak louder. So we knew.
Mary. All right. Thanks, Mimi, for that.
Thank you, Mimi.
We miss her. We miss Mimi every day of the world. Mimi Carter, Marcella Casals, these great gals from the past. But Mimi, we hope to see you soon. 60 seconds. I'm reaching for my trusty stopwatch. And you literally have 60 seconds to tell us, all our listeners, how you would change the world of theater for the better in Cumberland County.
Oh boy, 60 seconds is a lot. Not a whole lot of time. And go. I would have, to be honest, as much as I, and this is my own personal opinion, as much as I love
The space that the Gilbert resides in right now, I wish that it had its own space. And the reason why I think that would be beneficial to Cumberland County is I think we would be able to pull in a bigger audience. Even though each show in the last couple of years have absolutely filled the seats, which is great. And I'd also have, I don't know, sort of like a Justice League thing, have a team up, maybe, you know, CFRT and the Gilbert put on a production or something, or Temple Theater. I mean, we all use the same sort of actors and we bring people in, and I think that'd be a kind of a interesting thing to see, you know, all three. You know, you've got, that's all I got. I'm going to ramble, so I'm going to stop talking.
Well, no, excellent. 48 seconds, you brought up something that needed to be said. Both of those points, Matt.
And they could do the Gilbert recently did that that theater festival. It could be a big expansion of that involving all the theaters and doing original shows
right. Shows. No, exactly. That is good for you. Well, birthdays. We have some birthdays from celebrated people. Terrence McNally was born in this day in 1939. Bert Lancaster was born in this day in 1913. Richard Sheridan, this date in 1751. A.R. Gurney in 1930. And I hear that Mary and James, you have some local celebs.
October Morales, who works closely with the who's worked closely with the Gilberts, has a birthday November 9th. Jillian Brocky, who has done some shows with the Gilbert, and is also the daughter. Both her parents have done shows with the Gilbert and the Temple Theater. She is she has her birthday November 3rd. Alyssa Elkins. Her birthday is November 11th.
Alyssa,
I'm sorry. I'm a terrible person. Okay. Monica Stokes, works with the Gilbert as well. She has her birthday November 13th. Stanley C., a frequent collaborator and actor in the area. His birthday is November 13th. Garrett Howell, who I believe is a tiny child.
Who played
Pugsley in The Addams Family recently at the Temple Theater. His birthday is November 13th.
And he's from Fayetteville.
Uh-huh.
And he's from Fayetteville.
And he has a wonderful voice.
Beautiful.
He has a beautiful voice. Yeah. Also, I didn't feel he was quite fat. But, he sang that he was fat. I was like, no, this is a perfect excuse, child, for you to eat more ice cream this week and gain a lot more weight. But, yeah. I do wonder if that show ever gives any job any sort of body issues. I've been cast as Pugsley.
Thank you, James. Call board. We have CFRT is on.
CFRT is in the midst of their production of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I actually saw on opening night and was blown away. It was a terrific, terrific production, and it ends November 15th. Also, FTCC is they're starting the production of 9 to 5, the musical.
Wow.
November 6th, and it will run till November 22nd, and that show is all kinds of free, so yeah, you can go see that. And the Gilbert Theater is doing It's a Wonderful Life November 27th to December 20th, and you might be misled by the posters. The gentleman who is starring in the show is unfortunately a lot less handsome.
I will argue with that to the day.
Both handsome, absolutely both. No, Matt. No, it's true. You can catch Matt at the Cross Creek Mall. Nightly during the holiday season.
Yes, you can.
Matt, it's been wonderful having you here today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On November 12th, I thought it was another day as well, but Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as adapted by Jeffrey Hatcher, will be at Methodist University.
Oh, thanks, Mary.
On November 12th, I know, and I thought another day as well, but that's it.
So we have several things to see. Don't we? Matt, thank you so much for
coming. Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
So this is Lynn Pryor asking James to dim the lights and go to black while I urge you all to find a play to see this week. So until next Thursday, thanks for your company. Now, Matt, this is the end of our show, but I always have this P.S., this pod script.
Okay.
And I ask this question, and let's see if you know the answer.
Okay.
What is the universal question?
I have no idea.
No idea. Well, I'm not surprised. Nobody seems to have it, but I do know the answer. And it's safely locked away in my safe deposit box. And one of these days, I'm going to be breaking it out and sharing it. But I'm building the suspense because it's going to save the world.
For I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town. Yes, I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round, to be back where the boys all